As Benjamin Franklin walked out of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia one day, a group approached him wanting to know what sort of government the delegates had created. Franklin famously answered, "A republic, if you can keep it." You're listening to the sixth and final lecture in Wyoming Catholic College's distance learning course, Classical Roots of American Liberty. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at the college. Franklin understood that a regime that put liberty at its core would not stand based on government power or government laws. Instead, it depended on the character of individual men and women in their communities. It depended on town government more than national government, on civic associations more than government mandates, on families and churches more than the ruminations of Congress. In this final lecture, Professor Kyle Washit discusses civic associations and subsidiarity in America. That is, he discusses what is needed to have a republic and to keep it.
The land was ours before we were the land's. She was ours more than 100 years before we were her people. In his poem, The Gift Outright, Robert Frost offers a vision of the land and freedom that is at the root of the American ideal. Whether it was the Puritans first seeing the American shore, or intrepid pioneers journeying to ever-unfolding western boundaries, American settlers have known themselves to be partaking in an exodus into a promised land that offered to feed them the milk and honey of that freedom. Contrary to some perceptions, the story of American freedom is not principally a story of developing the right political workings, as if, given the right system at the top, freedom will trickle down to the people below. Rather, freedom is grown, as it were, from the ground up. Something rooted in the land, flowering into the homes, friendships, and townships of the pilgrims, while being facilitated and preserved by these settlers' common bonds and political assemblies. Now, one of the biggest proponents of this view is not someone who we would initially identify as a political philosopher. Nevertheless, he is a man who formulated some basic principles of how to understand freedom in society, principles which, in the end, were to help undermine the Soviet Union. And I mean no less of a thinker than St. John Paul II. Now, one of Pope John Paul II's constant themes was that there was a freedom that existed first and foremost as the right of the individual person, in virtue of his or her inalienable dignity. This freedom was then first expressed by relationships with various small communities, beginning with the family and spreading into economic, social, political, and cultural groups, which, in a way, stem from human nature itself, and which also have their own autonomy, or what we might call a rightful sovereignty. It is the human person and his network of societal relationships who acts, as John Paul II notes, within a culture, and he interacts with that culture. And it is this cultural sphere of action that both influences and ought to be served by the governing authority of the society. This is what underlies what the Pope calls the principle of subsidiarity. That is, the government, as a community of a higher order, arises from and is ordered to helping lower-level communities, not by interfering in their functions, but by supporting them and coordinating activities with the rest of the society with a view to the common good. Thus, the culture created by these smaller communities is prior to the state, and it is in cooperation with this culture that the state maintains the freedom of the individuals and the society at large, and vice versa. It is human persons acting as members of a free society that maintain the free nature of the state. Now, while acknowledging that there may be exceptional circumstances when the state needs to enter the cultural sphere and supplement social sectors for urgent reasons, namely reasons touching on the common good, John Paul II notes that such supplementary interventions must be as brief as possible so as to avoid removing permanently from the society its proper functions. So according to the Pope, the top-down view of liberty risks creating a society characterized by passivity, dependence, and submission to the bureaucratic apparatus, which, as the only ordering and decision-making body of the entire totality of goods, puts everyone in a position of almost absolute dependence. This provokes a sense of frustration or desperation and predisposes people to opt out of national life, a kind of psychological immigration from the political community. So the increase of state activity in the cultural sphere, no matter how well-intentioned, risks undermining the cultural sphere that preserves the freedom of the nation. Now, what I'm talking about is not merely a theological doctrine proposed solely on the force of religious authority. Rather, this bottom-up view of freedom was present from the very moment of our nation's founding. In fact, just moments after Benjamin Franklin emerged from the Constitutional Convention, he was asked by a woman, "What government did you give us?" His answer? "A republic, if you can keep it." Now note there are two parts to Franklin's answer. First, he specifies the kind of government given, and he specifies this as a republic. Now, the thing to stress about the word republic is republic doesn't indicate primarily a means of government, right? It instead indicates the end of government. As expressed by Franklin's contemporary Thomas Paine, what is called a republic is not any particular form of government. It is wholly characteristic of the purport, matter, or object for which government ought to be instituted and on which it is to be employed. Res publica, the public affairs or the public good. Republican government is no other than government established and conducted for the interest of the public, as well as individually and collectively. Now, the second part of Franklin's answer is equally important. He says a republic, and then he says, if you can keep it. For a government to be ordered to the common good, the government depends on the action of the people. Republics are not merely created by constitutional fiat. They have to be maintained by those people for whom they were created. And this requires a society that gives rise to authentic freedom and works at every level to pursue the good which transcends the government and toward which the whole society strives. Thus, in one short line, Franklin managed to communicate an iceberg of philosophy and practice that lay beneath the tip of the Constitutional Convention. Already in the time of the ancient Greeks, men were trying to articulate what kind of culture one needed in order to both preserve freedom, and further, they wanted to articulate what it would mean to have a government ordered to the common good as opposed to some set of individual concerns. And the first answer proposed was that what separated man from beast and free man from slave was the practice of political speech. When the Greek historian Herodotus told the story of the war between the Persians and Greeks in the 5th century BC, he told it as a conflict between the slaves who merely took orders from their dictator and the free men who gathered in the city to speak. And it was the free men who won. A contemporary of Herodotus, Aeschylus, wrote in his play Eumenides that Athena established the law court in Greece so that men could be ruled by speech and not a tyrant. And Aristotle, in arguing that the Greeks were both naturally free and naturally political, founded both in their ability to engage in political speech. But speech is not the sole foundation for freedom because speech needs a place in which to be exercised. People might be capable of speech and yet not come together to discuss the right and the wrong, and in such a situation, there would be no political community. The people would not be keeping or preserving a republic, as Franklin put it. Speech concerned with the common good and expressed by free men invested in government only comes to be if there is first a gathering for that speech to take place in. It is the assembly, therefore, that gives rise to the act of political speech. And this assembly, for the Greeks, had its roots in the home. For the poet Homer, the great teacher of the Greeks, marriage and family was the foundation from which civilization arose, and in defense of which the Greek people were willing to wage the Trojan War for 10 years. The familial halls of the king were the place where one first learned the story of one's land and how to evaluate what was truly good. And these halls opened to the wider world in virtue of the demand of hospitality. Guests were invited into your home to gather, deliberate, tell tales, and in short, engage in truly public speech. And then these guests would take the bonds of the hearth into the wider world, where the bonds would endure through commerce and even war, building up the wider political community. In Book 8 of Homer's Odyssey, the hero Odysseus arrives in the kingdom of the Phaeacians, and the king called the Phaeacian freemen to an assembly, in Greek, an agora. The assembly is in part intended to deliberate about a political matter, how to respond to this noble refugee and what gifts to give him. But at the same time, the assembly is far more than speech. The Phaeacians sing, they dance, they compete in athletic games, they give speeches, and they feast together. For Homer, all the activities of the assembly are signs of the freedom, nobility, and sovereignty of the Phaeacian men. In contrast to that horrid race of cyclopses who feast on human flesh and remain isolated alone in their caves, never gathering together, the Phaeacian assembly is a symbol of the free and glorious people that flows out of the family life of the nation. As Odysseus surveys those gathered, he rises, drink in hand, to give his own speech to the Phaeacians and to praise the order of their assembly. Quote, "This is indeed a truly splendid thing, for I say there's nothing that gives one more delight than when joy grips entire groups of men who sit in the proper order in the hall, feasting and listening to a singer, with tables standing there beside them, laden with bread and meat and filled cups. To my mind, this seems the noblest of things." End quote. The assembly, with its proper order and array of activities, stands as the most beautiful thing there is, akin to the perfection of human civilization and the mark of human freedom. From it arise the poetry of the nation, the expression of the dignity of its sovereigns, and noble political speech. So closely united were assembly and speech in the Greek mind that when Aristotle reflected on the philosophy of language and wrote a book reflecting on everything that could be spoken in view of the nature of human thought, he called his book what in English is transliterated as the categories, but in Greek, the kata agore. Words and thoughts are intended for the agora, for assembly, and hence the concept of assembly is intimately bound up with the very possibility of speech and with the preservation of the freedom of the republic. Now, over time, the Greek vocabulary shifted, and the word for assembly used by Homer, agora, came to mean the place where men gathered. But the name for the men as gathered in the agora was instead the Greek word ekklesia. All of the men of Athens had a right to vote on the governance of the city, but they were only called the ekklesia, that is, the assembly, when they gathered in the agora to exercise their governing power. Now, when Christianity emerged on the scene, it adopted the name ekklesia to refer to itself. In so doing, the very idea of assembly was expanded from being limited to the act of meeting in a particular place at a particular time, and came to include, in addition, the bonds of belief and friendship that united the members of the meeting both before and after their physical assembly. Thus, by sharing in the beliefs and friendship of a group, one was always a member of an ecclesia, of an assembly. And so for a Christian, the exemplar assembly, the exemplar of free civic friendship, was none other than the name she gave herself in Greek, ecclesia, which we have, through the German, come to translate as church. This understanding of assembly, building on the Greek heritage, was eventually one of the key components that developed into the Catholic social doctrine of subsidiarity that we discussed earlier. The greatest goal for a society is not to be collapsed into a streamlined organization under a centralized state, but is rather to allow these smaller assemblies to exist, not constrained by time or space, but to exist as permanent attributes of that society. Within these assemblies, human dignity is obvious, and civic solidarity and friendship flourish. This position is summarized in the Catholic Church's Compendium of Social Doctrine. Quote, "The profound meaning of civil and political life does not arise immediately from the list of personal rights and duties. Life in a society takes on all its significance when it is based on civil friendship and on fraternity." St. Thomas Aquinas, the theologian of the Middle Ages, most responsible for systematizing the relationship between the Greek heritage of political philosophy and the Christian experience, would go so far as to write, quote, "States are maintained by friendship, and legislators ought to be more zealous about it than about justice." Now, St. Thomas does not mean that the legislator ought to be unjust in order to promote his friends, but rather that the best guarantee of justice in a republic comes from civic friendship. If the legislator cultivates freedom within those mediating assemblies, justice will follow. If he neglects civic friendship and claims to focus on personal rights, the state may well dissolve all the same. And civic friendship springs up where people gather to share ideas and activities in common. Hence, the preservation of the assembly, understood as both church and those numerous small mediating institutions, beginning with the family and moving out through guilds and other associations, is the best way to secure civic friendship and to prevent tyranny. In fact, Aquinas notes elsewhere that this civic friendship cannot exist in its fullness in a state of tyranny. Only when the people are free is there true civic friendship, and is there a republic in the broad sense of the word we've been using. As noted for the Greeks, the contrast between slave and free was the contrast between those free to speak and those not. But speech arises from and flourishes in the assembly, which is the sign of the freedom and sovereignty of the people. Thus, if there is not freedom, there are no assemblies of free men. And if there are no assemblies of free men, there is no civic friendship. And if there is no civic friendship, there is nothing to bind the state and society together, and you cannot preserve a republic. This ancient Hellenic Christian view of freedom as coming first from families and rising and being built up through the connections of civil society is foundational also not only to the American settler experience I discussed at the beginning, and it was implicit in the remarks of Benjamin Franklin, but it is even more explicitly woven into the American Constitution itself, admittedly, however, by amendment. When in response, you see, to the anti-federalist concerns, Congress agreed to put forth 10 amendments to the Constitution as a way to secure the liberty of the people. One of the first freedoms specified was the freedom of assembly. And it was included in the start in the text of the First Amendment, which now states, among other things, "Congress shall make no law abridging the right of the people peaceably to assemble." Now, during the course of the House's discussion of the First Amendment, Robert Sedgwick of Representative Sedgwick of Massachusetts argued that the reference to a right to assembly should be dropped, saying, quote, "If people freely converse together, they must assemble for that purpose. It is a self-evident, unalienable right that will never be called into question." End quote. If we give a right to free speech, the right to assembly is redundant. Sedgwick's arguments here reverses the traditional order between assembly and speech. Free speech comes first and includes within itself the right to free assembly and free press. Sedgwick does not consider the subsidiarity that justified assembly, but rather he saw assembly as a larger form of expression deriving from free speech. Now, law scholar Michael McConnell describes what followed. John Page of Virginia, quote, responded that people have been prevented from assembling together on their lawful occasions, referring obliquely to William Penn's infamous prosecution in 1670 on the charge of unlawful assembly after he preached a Quaker sermon to a crowd assembled on Gracechurch Street in London. Therefore, it is well to guard against such stretches of authority by inserting the privilege in the Declaration of Rights. Page's reference to Penn was doubly suggestive. Penn's sermon occurred on a public street without official permission, and its subject matter was religious rather than political, and therefore beyond the proposed protection of assemblies gathered to discuss the common good under the auspices of free speech. Page also seemed to realize that governments, even in the new American Republic, might be prone to restrict freedom on various pretexts, which is why a separate enumeration would be valuable. And with Page's reminder of the Penn prosecution in mind, Congress rejected Sedgwick's motion by a large majority. End quote. For those who passed this First Amendment, the freedom of religion, speech, the press, and assembly were interwoven together. They were distinct rights in their own respect, and each deserved distinct protection. And together, they formed the foundation for the network of communities and associations that would nurture the culture necessary for freedom and the preservation of this republic. Further, not only were these rights interwoven, but in a sense, freedom of assembly was that which protected them all. As Representative Page noted, if the people could be deprived of the power of assembling under any pretext, they might be deprived of every other privilege contained in the clause. In passing the First Amendment, America blended the noble understanding of assembly with a strong respect for political pluralism. Whereas in the earlier history, assemblies were the privileged place of those with authority or of religions sanctioned by the state, here assemblies were interpreted as the proper right of all men arising from their natural freedom and dignity. So as I've been stressing, these assemblies arise out of a societal culture. And as with Franklin, so too Madison and the rest of the Federalists frequently referenced the people's responsibility for preserving this new republic and the need for a certain societal character to be able to do that. But the bulk of the work of the founders was devoted to the questions of the structure and function of the government proper. Their brilliant political science rarely offers us a detailed analysis of the principles and marks of the societal character they presume as essential to the preservation of the republic. Now, in part, this may be because it's hard to describe the environment you're surrounded by. Fish would have a hard time describing what it's like to be wet. So while the founders were able to recognize that the republic's survival depended on a national culture, they were so immersed in the culture of freedom that it took 50 years before a brilliant outside observer was able to describe what the precise characteristics were that were necessary for the successful practice of the art of freedom. Now, this man was none other than the Frenchman Alexis de Tocqueville, a 19th century aristocrat who visited America and wrote perhaps the best book ever written on either democracy or America. And it is appropriately entitled Democracy in America. De Tocqueville wrote his book as a self-professed lover of liberty and offered a study in what were the virtues necessary to provide for a free society. Now, a book written in the 1830s cannot speak to all aspects of modern political experience, but I maintain that Tocqueville offers us fundamental insights into the principles that are necessary to foster a culture that will preserve liberty. He names with precision the virtues and traits that are presupposed as necessary for a republic, and his insight is attested in his incredible ability to predict the course of society based on his understanding of the principles and characters of a people. Let me just offer some proofs of Tocqueville's remarkable ability to predict the future. First quote, "There are two great peoples on earth today who, starting from different points, advance toward the same goal, the Russians and the Americans. Their point of departure is different, their ways diverse. Nonetheless, each of them seems called by a secret design of Providence to hold the destinies of half the world in its hands one day. End quote. Besides the Cold War, our Nostradamus of democracy predicted a bit more. Quote, if America ever experiences great revolutions, they will be brought about by the presence of blacks on the soil of the United States. Talk radio? Again, Tocqueville. The spirit of the journalist in America is to attack coarsely, without preparation, and without art, the passions of those whom it addresses. The debate about tax loopholes. Quote, a democratic government is the only one in which those who vote for a tax can escape the obligation to pay it. And lastly, about the current size and scope of government, quote, persons may be ready to admit as a general principle that public authority ought not to interfere in private concerns. But as an exception to that rule, each of them craves for its assistance in a particular concern and seeks to draw on the influence of the government for his own benefit. You add a number of people together with time on its side, it may be asserted that the older a democratic community is, the more centralized will its government become. End quote. So we can at least concede that de Tocqueville seems to have been onto something in his observation of democratic societies. His insights are clearly worth listening to. In fact, at Wyoming Catholic College, we spend around 8 classes on him. But for the moment, I want to offer you just an overview of Tocqueville's account of the kind of culture that needs to exist in a democracy in order to ensure this culture of freedom that we've been pursuing. In the first place, de Tocqueville notes that a form of government is not sufficient to explain freedom. Freedom doesn't trickle down. Democracy, granted, is a form of government, and it's a government of and by the people, and it's characterized by a passion for equality. But this passion for equality, Tocqueville notes, exceeds the love of liberty and will lead to offenses against liberty. People will be so concerned with being equal that they will be willing to violate the freedoms of others and themselves in order to achieve better and better equality. Therefore, Tocqueville says, we need a new political and science that is intended to help navigate the democratic desire for equality in a way that will preserve freedom. And so first, America needs a definition of freedom. Now, Justice Kennedy has offered a definition of freedom in the case in Casey versus Planned Parenthood, and he referenced it again in the Supreme Court case Lawrence versus Texas. And there he writes, quote, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, of the mystery of human life, end quote. Now, Tocqueville's definition of freedom, which he proposes, is fundamentally opposite to Kennedy's. He says that his definition is greater than anything said by any European philosopher of the time, and it is a modified quote he offers us from the Puritan John Winthrop. Quote, let us not deceive ourselves about what we understand by our independence. There is, in fact, a sort of corrupt liberty, whose usage is common to animal and man, and which consists in doing all that one pleases. This liberty is the enemy of all authority. It suffers impatiently all rules. With it, we become inferior to ourselves. It is the enemy of truth and peace, and God believed it necessary to rise against it. But there is instead a civil and moral liberty that finds its force in union, and which it is the mission of power to protect. This is the liberty to do without fear all that is just and good. This holy liberty we ought to defend through all the hazards and expose for it, if necessary, our very lives. Now, the difference between these two definitions is immediately apparent. Tocqueville speaks of a moral and civil liberty understood based on the dignity of the individual, but in a way that is realized in communion with fellow men, the moral order, and God himself. It is not merely a freedom from any civil or even metaphysical authority. It is a freedom for the just and the good. While Kennedy's particular phrasing of the definition of freedom would not have been something Tocqueville was aware of, Tocqueville was aware of the precursor to Kennedy's definition. Indeed, much of what is the tradition called classical liberalism is based on an account of freedom that anticipates Kennedy's radical existential account. The Enlightenment philosophers of Europe were defining freedom as defined against society and authority. They proposed a myth of a state of nature where we imagine a person in radical individuality as his natural home. And then as he becomes aware of things that he desires, he enters into society as a way to secure his further desires, but at the same time protect his rights by a social contract. The individual in nature has an absolute freedom to do whatever he wants, but he gives up something of that to join society. What he doesn't give up, the fear of his own private influence, is what we still call freedom. Now, Tocqueville rejects this Enlightenment account for two reasons. First, it is an utterly mythical story. The state of nature is invented as a myth to explain the need for civil liberty and defend the right of revolution. But the appeal for studying America, according to Tocqueville, is that we can see the historical realities that underlie the emergence of this society. Other societies, Romans, Native American, Norse, you name it, are shrouded in the mists of myth. But in America, Tocqueville says, Providence has given us a torch to see the real emergence of a society and therefore truly understand those bases on which society is formed. Further, Tocqueville is also wary of the Enlightenment account of freedom because while it was invented as a way to help prevent tyranny, it instead actually risks tyranny. For the Enlightenment account will leave the individual isolated and naked before the power of the state. Depersonalized, anonymous, and unable even to protect his individual rights. The individual becomes an object to be courted with advertising or an object to be administrated, but not an individual with an inherent dignity and a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This radical individualism, where it's you versus the society as a whole, Tocqueville notes, is a gateway for tyranny. Quote, despotism sees the most certain guarantee of its own duration in the isolation of men, and it puts all its care into isolating them. There is no vice of the human heart that agrees with it as much as selfishness. A despot readily pardons the governed for not loving him, provided they do not love each other. He calls those who aspire to unite their efforts to create a common prosperity turbulent and restive spirits, and he names those who confine themselves narrowly to themselves good citizens. Despotism makes a public virtue of indifference. John Paul II, who we quoted at the beginning of our talk, says the same, quote, the totalitarian state tends to absorb within itself the nation, society, family, religious groups, and in the end, individuals themselves. Authentic democracy is possible only in a state ruled by law. It requires the necessary conditions to be present for the subjectivity of society through the creation of structures of participation and shared responsibility. End quote. It is only when one has these mediating groups, beginning with the family and arising higher, that one has the bonds of civic friendship necessary to prevent tyranny and preserve freedom. And it's this sense of freedom that Tocqueville wants to define and wants to keep, contrary to the Enlightenment precursors to Justice Kennedy. Now, Tocqueville's account of liberty, as opposed to these isolated individual accounts, presents the individual as connected to a natural civil moral network in a way that is prior or foundational to his connection to the state. The culture or social state that arises from the mutual interactions of these associations becomes the atmosphere and the medium through which the individual exercises his freedom and pursues those transcendent ideals to which he is called. Now, this atmosphere includes the history, the language, the habits of mind and heart through which society attempts to relate itself to these transcendent ideals, the common good toward which the republic is ordered. And this atmosphere is the fundamental condition for civil society. The individual does not just participate in culture as some atomic agent. Rather, the individual is introduced into the culture through a variety of intermediate institutions. And he then exercises his freedom through those very same associations. First and foremost among these institutions is the family. The human person is literally born into a culture. And Tocqueville describes the hearth as the first school of liberty, much as it was in the ancient Greek world. It is here that the individual first acquires the customs of a free man or woman. After the family, there are religious groups. So important is religion for the crafting of a culture of liberty that Tocqueville describes religion in America as the first political institution. We might say the fundamental assembly. And following these are various other organizations that give texture and depth to the society. Clubs, intellectual or cultural societies, advocacy groups, etc. They're all intermediate associations in which we take part, become enculturated, and develop the art of freedom in our assembling together. Tocqueville wrote, quote, "In the United States, they associate for the goals of public security or commerce, industry, morality, and religion. Americans of all ages, all conditions, and all minds constantly unite. Not only do they have commercial and industrial associations, they also have 1,000 other kinds, religious, moral, grave, futile, very general, very particular, immense, and very small. Americans use associations to give fetes, found seminaries, build inns, raise churches, distribute books, send missionaries. In this manner, they create hospitals, prisons, schools. Finally, if it's a question of bringing to light a truth or developing a sentiment, they associate. Everywhere that at the head of a new undertaking, in Europe you would see the government of France or a great lord in England, count on it that you will perceive an association in the United States. It is the associations that have replaced the ruling power of aristocracy," according to Tocqueville. Now, rising up out of these various associations, and in a way crowning them all, is the township. As Tocqueville noted, the township is the sole association that is so much in nature that everywhere men are gathered, a township forms by itself. Township society, therefore, exists among all people, whatever their usages and their laws may be. It is man who may make kingdoms. The township appears to issue directly from the hand of God. The township for Tocqueville was something natural to man, not something created by an artificial social contract. Thus, the authority of government, at least as established at the local level, is organically linked to man's exercise of freedom. The township's governmental authority is not an alien power that threatens freedom, but rather it is a force arising from man's free exercise of his social nature itself. Now, granting that a township arises naturally, we are not in a position to say that freedom, this right of each individual person, can be explained without reference to society. And if there is a society, as de Tocqueville notes, there must be some authority. So humans by nature are supposed to live in society under some kind of authority, and yet at the same time, they're endowed by nature to be free and to keep the government from encroaching on their freedom. Thus, the role of government can be seen in analogy to Odysseus in Homer's Odyssey as he journeys home, sailing between a whirlpool, the Charybdis, and the monster Scylla. Thus, too, government is to provide a juridical framework that respects, on the one hand, the freedom of the individual, the family, and those secondary and cultural institutions, and on the other hand, prevents anarchy. We must navigate our boat between going too close to government control and ending in tyranny, or too close away from any kind of authority and ending in anarchy. Rather, by preserving the right balance of associations in communion with the governing structure, we preserve society. Every member of society, as the Compendium of Social Doctrine says, is permitted to fulfill his personal vocation, to seek the truth, profess his religious, cultural, and political ideas, to express his opinions, to choose his state of life, and as far as possible, his line of work. But, John Paul II notes, when society is so organized as to reduce arbitrarily or even suppress the sphere in which freedom is legitimately exercised, the result is that the life of society becomes progressively disorganized and goes into decline. So here we have two references for the word freedom. One, namely the arrangement of government, that allows individuals, their families, and the cultural society they act within to function as subjects with a certain kind of sovereignty, a certain freedom appropriate to their level. And then we get a list of negatives from that perspective. We want a lack of interference into speech or into the press, a lack of interference into private property, and thus we call free speech or free press those things characterized by that absence. But the second sense of freedom refers to the work of the individual within the spheres of family, religion, society, and culture. And it is this freedom that needs to underlie the government and governmental freedom and preserve the republic. Thus, Tocqueville notes that three things preserve liberty in America: geography, laws, and habits of mind and heart. And it is these habits of mind and heart that are most fundamental. And the tyranny, therefore, that threatens America, Tocqueville sees as of two kinds. One, that Americans become oblivious and get caught up in their concern for only material gain. And two, the oppression of one group by another, the tyranny, we may call, of the majority. The small social structures that are prior to the state are essential for the prevention of both kinds of tyranny. Religious groups, jury duty, political associations that draw people outside of themselves and engage with larger issues enlarge our sentiments, educate us, stretch us, and prevent us from becoming so narrowly focused on our own money that we neglect the question of societal freedom. At the same time, small associations help temper the tyranny of the majority. They improve civilization from barbarism. Note again, the difference between the Cyclops in Homer versus the high point of civilization in the Phaeacians. And they increase the strength and authority of individuals. No longer is it the individual against the mob, but there are different associations working together, cooperating for the common good. Yet both this essential art of assembly and the practice of free subsidiarity that it implies are currently in jeopardy. In 1958, the Supreme Court introduced a new right, not named in the Constitution, the right of association. And in the last 30 years of jurisprudence, the court has decided cases bearing on the constitutional right to free assembly solely in terms of free speech or this newly crafted right to association. So successfully has free assembly been replaced by the right to association that at least 25 federal district and appellate court opinions refer to a freedom of association clause in the Constitution, even though no such clause exists. Now one might ask, what's in a name? Tocqueville talks about association, and he means association to represent this sovereign art of assembly that helps temper both forms of tyranny that are a threat to Americans. But what we need to note here is that the way the court has described association has utterly neglected the vision of freedom rooted in subsidiarity that underlies the Western tradition of assembly we've been considering. Since 1958, the court began to include two very different kinds of association under its newly created right. In the first place, it talked about a right to associate for the sake of political expression. And then it talked about a right to associate in intimate settings, such as that of the family. In fact, this latter form of the right of association was used to determine that married couples, and subsequently anyone, had a right to contraception. The right of association was given its most definitive shape in 1980 in the Supreme Court case Roberts versus USJCs. In that case, the Supreme Court decided that the government could tell an association dedicated to the advancement of young men to change their membership rules and their mission such that they were now dedicated to the advancement of young men and young women. This is striking, since prior to this, the very act of deciding who to assemble with was seen as a sovereign political right. But under the new case law, this right is not an absolute guarantee. In coming to this decision, the court ruled that there are two kinds of association afforded constitutional protection, as we've discussed, intimate association and expressive association. Intimate associations, while undefined, are seen as expressions of the individual right to privacy that is applied to some other person. Hence, marriage and familial bonds are intimate associations. My right to privacy covers over my spouse or my family, and they are included in virtue of intimate association under the right I have to privacy. Expressive associations are those associations directly enlarging their right to free expression by associating. So while intimate associations are beyond the pale of government intervention, expressive associations can be limited if the government has a compelling reason. Now, both kinds of associative rights are problematic in terms of the larger tradition. In the first place, to list marriage and family as intimate associations separated from government interference by a wall of privacy serves to cut the family off from any claim to freedom and sovereignty within the public square. It ceases to be an intermediate association that helps preserve freedom and instead is locked firmly away. Whereas under the subsidiarian doctrine of free assembly, family is prior to the state and seen as a condition, like the more developed assemblies, for the exercise of political sovereignty and freedom, and with its very existence communicating something to the public square, now they're hidden behind a curtain of intimacy, left to the determination of the individual's autonomy in accord with Justice Kennedy's conception of freedom discussed above. Thus, we are left with only two options. The rights of association are either protected in the privacy of the house, or they are open to state regulation when they interact with the common good. The right to expressive association is also problematic. Whereas the assembly naturally arose out of the family and flowered ultimately into the township and then the state, expressive association now has no such root. Instead, according to the Supreme Court, it presupposes the existence of the state, and is an extension of a citizen's right to political speech in a larger context. Thus, the right to expressive association needs to be evaluated solely within free speech doctrine, not subsidiarity, as Representative Sedgwick argued 200 years ago. Since expressive association is now considered a derivative right, it can also be more readily sacrificed by the state. For example, the courts have ruled that government should not be compelled to subsidize expressive associations opposed to public interest, with subsidy here taken to mean providing access to public forums, like libraries or city parks. Hence, no longer do assemblies have an inherent claim to the public square, but instead associations are only allowed to act in public forums if the government does not believe this subsidizes discrimination. This negative implication of both intimate and expressive association was highlighted this last month in the court's last few years, in the court's ruling in Obergefell versus Hodges. There, Justice Kennedy invoked the principle that intimate associations were solely defined by private will, and therefore concluded that the state must recognize a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. He then carried the implications of the expressive association to their next step by noting, quote, that religions and those who adhere to religious doctrines may continue to advocate with utmost sincere conviction that same-sex marriage should not be condoned. The First Amendment ensures that religious organizations and persons are given proper protection as they seek to teach the principles central to their faith. The same is true of those who oppose same-sex marriage for other reasons. In turn, those who believe allowing same-sex marriage is essential may engage those who disagree with their view in an open and searching debate. Kennedy's language, as John Roberts noted in his dissent, has moved even the exercise of religion and the assembling therein into the realm of advocating, debating, and teaching. It has fallen fully under the ambit of free speech alone. Again, speech where freedom is defined as a lack of governmental interference under certain conditions, not speech defined as the flowering of a freedom under the principle of subsidiarity. So here we are, bequeathed an invented right to association, which cuts us off from the great tradition of political assembly, interprets marriage, family, and other associations not in terms of subsidiarity, but instead with a stark view of individual autonomy, and does not provide adequate protections for minorities wishing to assemble for their positions in the public square. It should not be surprising that in a legal culture that discourages robust assembly, we see a civic culture moving away from the bonds of public friendship and a resulting drop in civic engagement. Since Robert Putnam's 2000 book, Bowling Alone, sociologists have been tracking the radical decline in Americans' participation in small intermediate assemblies, from bowling clubs to neighborhood block parties. Putnam argued, like Tocqueville, that such decline is related to neglect in civic engagement. In 2011, Dr. Christian Smith, a sociologist from Notre Dame, published Lost in Transition,
a study of what Smith calls emerging adulthood, that is, the newly forming demographic of young people between the ages of 18 and 30 in America. Dr. Smith and his colleagues describe what they see as defining and disturbing features of the group. 27% of emerging adults are so apathetic about politics, they are completely divorced from civic involvement. 13% are politically disengaged because they're too uninformed to be involved, while another 10% believe they can't make a difference. Another 19% are so distrustful of governmental authority that they abstain from political participation. 27% actually identify themselves as politically active, but for them this means occasionally voting and sometimes watching the news and having a conversation about it. Only 4% of young people between 18 and 30 are in fact genuinely political. The causes of disengagement are varied, but many of them are related to a lack of identification with various intermediate associations of society and the resulting narrowing focus on self that Tocqueville predicted. Radical individualism, an obsession with materialism, a lack of a sense of moral connection to the community, and a range of technological activities that have replaced previous cultural interactions. If we're trying to predict what this means for civil society, almost 200 years ago, Tocqueville vividly predicted the consequences of such a trend, and his predictions have tended to be accurate. Quote, "I see an innumerable crowd of like and equal men who revolve on themselves, procuring the small and vulgar pleasures with which to fill their souls. Each of them withdrawn apart is like a stranger to the destiny of all others. His fellow citizens dwell beside him, but he does not see them. He touches them, but does not feel them. Above these, an immense power is elevated, which alone takes charge of assuring their enjoyments and watching their fate. So it is that every day it renders the employment of free will less useful and more rare. It confines the action of the will in a smaller space, and little by little steals the very use of it from citizens. Thus, the sovereign extends its arm over society as a whole. It covers its surface with a network of small, complicated, painstaking, uniform rules. It does not break wills, but it softens them, bends them, directs them. It does not tyrannize, it hinders, compromises, innervates, and finally reduces the nation to being nothing more than a herd of timid and industrious animals, of which the government is the shepherd. Yet in the face of such a problem, the tradition of Western liberty gives us a simple solution. That is the practice of free subsidiarity. In other words, culture must grow from the ground up. Protecting the familial source of political freedom, inviting people within one's home and meeting them on the front porch, participating in associations like the Knights of Columbus, book club, or the like, engaging with the township through city council meetings and community news, celebrating in festive assemblies devoted to speeches, songs, and games, like what characterized Homeric Fakia or the traditional 4th of July. These are the solutions that Tocqueville and the entire Western tradition propose to us. But in the absence of assembly and subsidiarity, there is always tyranny. And where there is tyranny, there is no civic friendship. And where there is no civic friendship, the state will fall apart. But just as for our forebears, the vast expanses of the American landscape still beckon, still invite us to cultivate the freedom that is meant to grow here, that is meant to flourish in our homes, our churches, and our assemblies, and so preserve a republic worthy of this land and its people.
Thank you for listening to this distance learning course about the classical roots of American liberty from Wyoming Catholic College. You can visit our website to access our other distance learning courses, and we'll be sure to keep you informed about future courses. In addition, you may be interested in the After Dinner Scholar, the college's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. You can get to the After Dinner Scholar podcasts through the college website at Podbean.com. or through iTunes. Finally, if you're looking for a face-to-face adult learning experience, join us for the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought here in Lander, Wyoming. The 2019 school is June 9th to the 14th with the topic, No Greater Gift, Friendship from the Iliad to Facebook. And for those planning out further ahead, while we've not set a topic, the 2020 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought is planned for June 8th to 12th, 2020. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.